right, that settles it. This is the beginning of the Eric Anders Lang Show. One of the rare episodes where we have three people talking. Let's start with Blake, alphabetically speaking. You're next. And the situation of the chairs here. Blake Mikoski, how do you introduce yourself to people who have no idea what you do?
I typically explain that I am the founder and chief shoe giver of Toms.
Shoe giver, I like that.
Yeah, and
I wore my Toms today.
I appreciate that. And you're wearing them with socks, which is what I'm told is what all the cool kids are doing these days.
Isn't that really? That was unintentional.
No, seriously. When you walked up and you had this outfit with the socks, I was like, he's in the know. I have no socks. I have the same Toms on, but no socks. Because I stick to, like, originally. And I always thought, like, no socks. Like, socks are weird with Toms. But now, all, like, the age, like, from, like, 16 to, like, 32-year-old cool kids that work at Toms or interns, they all wear them with socks.
That's so interesting.
You're right in.
You know, to be totally honest, it was a complete mistake. I put the socks on, and then I put the shoes on. I was like, yeah, I should wear the Toms today. That's right.
Yeah.
It wasn't planned out.
Yeah, you look great.
And then maybe you can talk about Mac, who's sitting next to you. You guys have a relationship. I'm curious to learn more about that. But Mac is sitting next to you. He's the third member of the podcast today.
Yeah, Mac and I met a couple years ago, and he's the founder of UGP. Which he's going to get to talk to you about. And I'm a big supporter and mentor and friend, and it's been awesome.
Very cool. Mac, what's the gossip on Blake? Let's get real. What's the gossip here?
What's the gossip on what?
On Blake. What does he got? No, I'm kidding. you were generous enough to host a party, right, that I had over at UGP.
That's right.
How do you define UGP? I mean, it's a little, I try and define it, and I feel like I always mess it up. What do you call it?
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially everything you would need for golf performance, for training your game under one roof. Golf instruction, club fitting, club building, fitness training, and then like health and recovery services, like all under one roof. So like you're part of a college golf team and the kind of things that a Division I program would have, all under one roof together.
So it's like
for us amateurs. You didn't get a college scholarship to golf or get a chance to play pro.
That's right.
It's like, feel like pros.
Is it like summer camp for like wannabe astronauts kind of?
You know, it's like a little bit like that.
I like that.
Right?
Yeah, no, that's a great, I mean, you go there and you get to totally geek out on all things golf and you get to block out the world, your stress, your kids, your work. I mean, that's why I love it.
Is it like an indoor country club on some level?
In some regards, you know, in a lot of ways, it's really an academy, you know, an institution where you can go in and you can train, and on a regular basis, something that you're doing, you know, 2 to 3 times a week for your wellness, for your strength and conditioning, for your technique. You can check on your equipment. You can have custom equipment built for you on site there. So it's really just a full scope golf performance service and academy.
But what's interesting is I know guys that come only for the massage and bodywork stuff.
Really?
Yeah, because they're like, these are the best in town. And so they just get in there and just get work done.
That's a large... Well, I would assume also a golfer's massage is probably different.
Very
from...
Different. Yeah, it's more physical therapy than massage. Like,
right.
It's really about getting your body moving better. So it's less about a relaxing moment. It actually is kind of painful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the cool part. I mean, we've got two locations, one in LA and one in Orange County, and... You know, both of them have teams of about, you know, 12 to 15 staff members per location. And you have golf professionals, you have physical therapists, you have fitness trainers, you have master club builders, master club fitters, all working together for each individual client or member that's coming in the door.
Right.
So that's the nice part about it. Nobody's independent contractors. They're all full-time employees and they all work together and collaborate to be able to provide the best member experience possible and get people better at golf fast.
And I found out because I've lucky enough to get to play in the AT&T program.
Awesome.
I played in it 9 years now in a row. My dad caddies for me. I mean, it's like, talk about golf heaven. I mean, we totally geek out. We rent a house on the second hole. We like invite all of our friends.
Great.
And so I met Mac, you know, 3 years ago in UGP, and I always looked at like January as like my get ready for Pebble month. Like, super busy with two kids, work, travel, that, you know, I don't get to play a ton of golf, but I always try to play a lot before the tournament so I don't embarrass myself and maybe I even have a chance to make the cut, and which I've done 3 times out of 9.
Whoa.
So 30% cut making is pretty, I'm pretty proud of that. But 3 years ago, I learned about UGP and it was great for me because I just go one place and kind of work on everything. And I spend a lot of hours there.
Well, and you probably maximize your time in a lot of ways.
Exactly. Yeah. You're not driving, especially a place like LA, right? Like if you're going to go, you know, first you can go to the gym and then you got to drive across town to maybe have, you know, swing coach. And then you want to go, you know, get this done. It can be a real pain in the ass. So the nice thing about, you know, doing them in big metropolitan areas where there is a lot of traffic and typical providers of these services would be spread out, you can just go to one place and then, you know, 1 or 2 hours, knock it all out.
Right. I was like, there's so many things I wanted to talk about real quick.
But I like this tattoo first.
You like
the
that?
The triangle with the...
That's a
triangle right here. Oh, I can't see it, but right there.
Yeah?
And my son's name is Summit, so
okay.
The triangle is kind of his symbol.
I like
symbol.
That.
Yeah.
This, this to some people means I'm a lesbian, actually.
Really?
Yeah, but that's actually, I'm not a lesbian.
Okay.
I mean, I am. I'm into women exclusively. I don't know. To others, it symbolizes I don't drink.
Oh, really?
Actually, yeah. So Sober October has been the last 17 years of my life.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Cool. So is that an actual, like, universal symbol that, like,
yeah.
If people see that, they don't even...
Yeah, it symbolizes, like, membership in a 12-step program,
yeah,
which
cool.
I don't talk about too much specifically,
yeah.
Aside from, you know, being sober. I also don't do it as much as I used to, but the idea is that the circle is supported by Unity, Fellowship, and Service.
Yeah.
And I think that I might have fucked it up, actually. It's been a while. Anyway, I still don't drink, so that's the good thing.
Yeah,
but,
that's the most important part of the story.
It was actually the first tattoo I ever got.
Yeah, I love it.
And apparently there's a superstition about getting that. Because, I mean, not everyone stays sober.
Stays sober, yeah, yeah.
So that's
yeah, I have a lot of friends that are sober, and they're very involved in AA, and it's been an amazing
yeah.
organization.
Yeah,
I love the I love the origin story of
it. It really is good.
It's incredible.
And it's kind of one of these few things on Earth that is not-for-profit.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is...
Yeah.
Perfect segue into the next subject. No, I mean, that's a big part of your life. No,
sure.
Seriously. I mean, that's I couldn't have planned it better myself.
Yeah.
I guess first, before we go there, because you are a big giver.
Yeah.
Right, shoe giver.
Mm-hmm.
More than that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But
I also believe in profit.
I do.
Like you got to make money to do good in the world.
Well, and you have interesting ways of breaking down how that works, I've
sure.
heard. I really like those ideas. But we first, have you ever heard that quote from the Buddha about the leather and the road and the shoes?
Yes. Yeah, it's a great one.
Tell it to me. I feel like you live by this in some ways.
Yeah, it's great. So I forget who he was, but this, you know, famous king, and he wanted wanted his feet to only touch the most softest leather wherever he walked. And all of his people, they were thinking about spending basically all the fortune of the kingdom and not spreading any of the wealth to the people who need it the most, and like hoarding all the wealth so they could pave all the streets in leather. And I forget who recommended this, but instead, just with like absolute, you know, perfect clarity, said, instead, why don't we just strap two pieces of leather to your feet? And you will always walk in leather.
Right.
And so that's, I think the quote is, you know, from the Buddha or from, you know, I forget, but it's such a great point, is that, you know, just by thinking things a little bit differently, you can totally change your perspective.
Does that relate somehow to how you approach business? Because, I mean, we were in the yard here. We're in a teepee right now, first of all.
Yeah, we are in a teepee in Topanga.
If you're listening, we're in a teepee in Topanga, which is somewhere between Malibu and Mars. I'm not sure. But you know, anyway, we're in the yard talking about it, and you were saying that you used to live on a sailboat, between a sailboat and an air mattress, which, you know, may not be exclusive. But, you know, from what I'm understanding, you have a pretty interesting like framework for doing business, which may not be all that quote different, but ends up in a radically different product. Can you
sure.
is can yeah. you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, my philosophy. You know, I started my first company. I was 18 years old, dropped out of college, and I recognized that I had a gift for being an entrepreneur. You know, and as
how did you recognize that?
Because like when I was 19 or 20, people would label me a young entrepreneur. And so I looked up the word. I didn't even know what entrepreneur meant. I literally looked it up at 19 years old and read. And I was like, yeah, that sounds like what I want to do with my life. Like, you know, seeing opportunities where other people don't, creating a business that can then generate, you know, revenue, and then creating the type of businesses that I could go play golf and it still makes money. or I could be sleeping and it still makes money. And that's really what being an entrepreneur is about, versus if you're, my dad's a doctor. And so he always says, like, he's not making money unless he's using his hands. So if he's playing golf, he's actually not only not making money from the surgery that he could be doing, but he also has the opportunity cost of being playing golf or being on vacation. Whereas an entrepreneur creates something that sustains itself and has an economic engine that continues to move whether you're there or not.
I think I have to leave this podcast right now. I have to go figure some shit out.
So I created this laundry business when I was 18 years old, and it started making money whether I was there or not.
A laundry business.
Backing up just a second. Yeah, kind of fluff and fold, dry cleaning. Backing up a second, I wanted to be a professional tennis player. That was my whole life growing up as a kid.
Interesting.
And so I went to the tennis academy. I moved away from home at age 15. Like, I was just myopically focused on becoming the next Andre Agassi. And I was pretty good. Like, I was top 100 in the country in singles, top probably 20 in the country in doubles. I went to SMU on a partial tennis scholarship. Like, I wasn't, I mean, in reality, I was never going to be, you know, the next Roddick or Agassi, but I was, you know, a really good player. And so I learned a lot of the things that have helped me in life, you know, discipline and commitment and, you know, a sport that you're by yourself, just like golf, you have to figure it out. And but my sophomore year in college, I had a partial tear to my Achilles tendon, and I was on crutches for like 6 months.
Oh.
And if you're on crutches, it's really hard to carry your laundry down to the basement of the dorm where you do it. So think about that. Like, it's impossible to take laundry somewhere on crutches. And so it piled up in my dorm room. My roommate didn't like it much. And ultimately, we came up with this idea that a lot of people don't like to do laundry. So we'll create the first ever pickup and delivery laundry service for kids at SMU. I was just in Dallas, literally 2 weeks ago, and I was driving by this campus, and the trucks are still running. 22 years later, my first business is still going. Now, I sold it years ago, but it's nice to see that this idea I had as an 18-year-old, now as a 42-year-old, is still cranking out and doing people's laundry. So that's where it started, and that's when I discovered this idea of creating something and building something that provides service where other people maybe didn't see an opportunity. But besides that, one of the things I loved about entrepreneurs as I learned more about it is the ones that were successful typically made a lot of money. And the ones that I had got to meet in Dallas and that started to mentor me in my early 20s, not only did they make a lot of money, they also were really philanthropic. And I thought that was the coolest thing. Like, I just thought, this is amazing that you could build something, make a lot of money, have a lot of, you know, nice experience in your life, but then, like, actually, like, really change people's lives, whether it's in sub-Saharan Africa, or it's in Detroit, or it's in downtown LA. And right. So there was something that just, like, I just, at age 20, committed my life. I said, I'm going to make as much money as I can, and then I'm going to spend my 60s, 70s, and 80s giving it all away. And I literally wrote that down, like, in my journal, like, at age 20. And I was like, I'm just going to, like, crank and work so hard until 60. And at 60, I'm going to give it all away until I die. And that was my goal.
Is everyone in this room, like, insanely inspired right now? Are you, Mac?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, he's an amazing guy, and I love the philosophy. It's inspiring for sure.
Yeah, no, it's cool. I mean, and it's funny because when a lot of people say a lot of things kind of like that, like, you know, actually, a lot of people say a lot of things like that you can kind of see through on some level, you know. Now, Tony Robbins is the one, I hear him a lot, and he's like, you know, one of my favorite things about him is like, the idea is to help as many people as possible.
Yeah.
Right? That's one of his fundamental.
He walks a lot.
Yeah. And, you know, that inspires me.
Yeah.
Right? And yeah, it's cool. It's cool.
You know, it's so that was the start, but then what really radically changed was when I was 29. I had started a couple of businesses just trying to make money. Some were somewhat successful, some were total failures. But at 29, I was down in Argentina and I saw all these kids that didn't have shoes. And I was really had this desire to help them, but I didn't have the resources yet. I hadn't made enough money to really help them philanthropically. And so the idea I had was, you know, what if you actually combined the two life plans, like the 0 to 60 life plan of making money and the 60 to maybe 90 life plan of giving away money. And at 29, at 30, you know, right before I turned 30, what if I just combined them now? And so I create a business where I try to make money, but every time I sell a pair of shoes, I give one to a child that doesn't have shoes. And if I could build a for-profit business doing that at the same time of helping people, then I wouldn't have to wait till I'm 60 to have that joy of giving. And it was a really small idea. You know, I came back with like 250 pairs of shoes, just like the ones you're wearing right now, in like duffel bags, making them in people's garages in Argentina. And, you know, I had no idea that it would become what it has become. But when I started Tom's, it was like, okay, like my goal is to get maybe 1,000 kids a year a pair of shoes, and I'll go to Argentina and give them away.
That was the goal.
That was the goal.
1,000.
1,000.
What number are you at now?
So we've given 87 million.
Jeez.
87 million, yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah, we might hit 100 million next year.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's blown away anything that I imagined.
So I guess I want to make sure. Hang on. Where are we at here? We got, yeah, everybody, hang on a second. We're going to go to a quick ad, and then I'm going to ask him about golf. Everybody stand by. Yo, all right, the Adidas, y'all, get into it. I know you may have seen those sick NMDs that I was wearing the other day, the Gore-Tex jams. Anyway, here we go. This is from Adidas. Get the year and your golf game off on the right foot, quite literally. We all know a good golf swing starts from the ground up, and luckily Adidas has you covered. Tour 360, Addy Power Forged, Addy Cross, Addy Pure, all with Boost. That's with a couple extra O's in there for pleasure. The best cushioning in the game, I can attest to that, but also all designed to perform on the course, so all you have to think about is your swing, which is definitely complicated enough. If you're like me, head over to adidas.com, click on the golf section, and find the style that's right for you. You can also follow Adidas Golf, at Adidas Golf, for all the latest news and info. Check it out. So when did you did golf come in around the Achilles heel?
No, well, so golf,
because really, you're a massive, massive golfer.
I love golf. Yeah.
Is there anything you would do other than golf, all things equal?
Yes, yeah, surfing.
Surfing,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I would say there's three things, hobby-wise, that I just am passionate about.
Right.
Surfing, playing polo, and golf. And maybe snowboarding.
Polo's the wild card. I wasn't expecting that
yeah.
one.
That came from Argentina. I learned
on
when
horses.
I was doing, yeah.
Gangster.
It's intense.
All of a sudden, you became James Bond. For a while, you were someone else, and you just became James Bond. Do you spend time in a submarine ever? Do you ever go
never
deep,
been in a
into
submarine.
The deep sea?
No, not yet.
Okay. You know what? Polo, I don't know if we're going to get to that on the podcast today. I just don't know if I have the bandwidth for that. But
golf and surfing.
But golf and surfing, you know, we got Kelly Slater and Adam Scott, obviously, yeah. Big proponents of both.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you straddle the gap between golf and surfing?
You know, it's really seasonal for me. So I play a lot of golf, you know, kind of leading up to the AT&T Pro-Am, which I love doing every year. And I play a ton of golf in the summer. My family, we live in Jackson Hole, Wyoming in the summer. I do a lot of climbing, too. That's another hobby of mine. And so in the summer, it's basically climbing, polo, and golf, just rotating every other day. Jeez. And so a lot of activities in the summer.
Now you might be Ralph Lauren. I'm not sure.
And so for me, in the summer, it's like all about golf, and then usually like January, February is all about golf, and then in between, it's a lot of surfing. And then when I'm here, you know, I live 8 minutes from Topanga Surf Break, and right. I like going up north of Santa Barbara and surfing up there a lot. So for me, surf is really dependent on are the waves.
You know?
So like all things equal, I mean, in all honesty, like if I had a game of golf set up with a Mac, and we saw a big south swell coming, I would cancel golf and go surfing.
No shit.
Because
I respect that.
No, but because you can't, like, you don't have a great swell every day.
Right.
You know, usually in LA, the golf courses are pretty good every day.
You're pretty set. Yeah. I mean, rain, you might cancel. You would cancel golf for rain.
Yeah. You know? But I kind of like playing in rain.
I wouldn't. I would like to play
in
rain.
Yeah, I like playing in rain.
So, but you know,
actually,
I guess...
like to go places and practice in the rain before pebble, because oftentimes you have to play in the rain.
Ah, there you go.
No amateurs are practicing.
You're
in the
good
rain.
At preparing. That's good. Important business about preparation. I'm looking at surfing and I'm thinking, it just sounds so much easier. You just chuck the board in the car, you drive over to the edge, and then you jump in, and then you're done whenever you want.
And you typically don't have good and bad surfing days. Like, your surfing skill level is pretty consistent. Like,
and is it necessarily like, for example, a lot of times when you leave the golf course, right, are you unfortunately tethered to not a score necessarily, but maybe just ball striking?
I mean definitely, or losing a match or winning a match or losing a bet or winning a bet.
And so you take that
but
away
I've
with you in
past
the car.
That. I mean, honestly, like, I used to be, I'm very competitive, but I think now, like, my relationship to golf, maybe it's becoming a dad, and maybe it's just spending more time, like, being more mindful. Like, I am so grateful any day I get on the golf course.
Right.
Like, I really have a deep, like, a deeper relationship with golf. It used to be so about winning, and competitive. And I think that came from my tennis experience.
Right.
But now it's like, I just don't take any day for granted. Like any day on the golf course is a good day.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you, Mac, do you, since you're now entered, were you, well, you and I met at Wilshire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were members there together for a while. I canceled my membership. I can't stop talking about it. It's like an ex-girlfriend that won't answer my calls. No, it's fine. I actually have felt real free now, you know, because I have time to do whatever I want. But, you know, we met there and, you know, we have a lot of friends in common. Do you find, though, because I sometimes find this as working in the golf industry, it kind of can keep me from playing golf to some extent. Do you find that, Mac?
You know, yeah, in some ways. I mean, I find myself where, you know, the game can feel a little bit like work. And I think that, I mean, for me, that dates back to when I was a teenager. I mean, golf, trying to play professional golf, collegiate golf, that sort of thing, you know, grinding on the range. So the burnout was pretty strong for me as a teenager. I went through that whole program. That's kind of why UGP exists is you know, when I was also like Blake too, trying to become a professional athlete. And I went to IMG Academy and trained there as a kid and went through the process of, you know.
Can you explain IMG Academy for people who don't know what it is? IMG Academy is basically like, that is like NASA school for like the real Neil Armstrongs.
It was, yeah. I mean, that's kind of where the first ideas of UGP even came to my mind, was having, you know, golf instructors and fitness trainers and physios. And we had, you know, competitive competition planners. We had, you know, golf psychologists there. And we just practiced every day. You'd go to school from, you know, you'd start out at the IPI dome, which is their integrative physiology dome. You'd go and work out with all the other athletes at like 6 a.m. And then you'd go to class from like 8 to 12, and then they'd bus you to the driving range. Now they have a course on campus, but bus you to the driving range, and you'd practice until, you know, 6-7 o'clock. And then we'd get back to school. You'd have study hall and you'd go to bed. It was just repetitive like that, just preparing you for college sports and for the professional.
Does that sound as, is that as fun as it kind of sounds?
You know, the academy was awesome. I mean, I made friends from all over the world. You're there with like people from Spain and Korea. I mean, it's just like this international academy.
It's elite. You can't just get in.
Yeah, it was an incredible experience. You can just get in. You could just pay to get in.
Dang.
You know, and it's really expensive. I think it was like maybe 35, 40 grand a semester.
Whoa.
Wow.
So,
you got to make some cuts.
They had some kids on scholarships there, like, you know, like Casey Wittenberg, who had the lowest finish as an amateur. I think, Paula Creamer was there on a scholarship. It's just, you know, it is amazing. It was an amazing experience, and it came to fame from the tennis academy, from Nick Bollettieri, and then David Ledbetter came in and built his academy, and then IMG's, you know, completely taken it over, and I don't think they have any labels of instructors there anymore. But when I was there, it was the David Ledbetter Academy. But yeah, it was incredible from the standpoint of, you know, getting that kind of exposure and training and training with all the best players. I mean, I was working with Gary Gilchrist at the time, who was the lead instructor, who still works with Paula.
Okay.
And Julia de Granada and all these different players, LPGA Tour players. And Michael Campbell had just won the US Open.
Okay.
And so you're going to take your golf lesson, you know, which is almost like twice a week kind of thing.
Jeez.
And
wow. I couldn't handle that managed instruction.
That's a lot.
It was a lot of instruction. It was a lot of mirror work. It was a lot of swing thoughts.
It's crazy.
And that's the way that David Ledbetter sort of taught in that whole program. And it works for some people. And for some, it really kind of takes away the love of the game. And I would go on the range, though, and he's working with Michael Campbell. And then Michael Campbell would walk away, and I'd get in there. And I'm like, these guys obviously know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Right.
Michael Campbell just won the US Open. But yeah, it did. It kind of made golf not fun. It made it like work. It made it like a chore. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of swing thoughts. I went there as like a +3, you know, pretty elite junior golfer. Hard for me to really shoot above par to within the first.
Hang on. Sorry. Hard for you to shoot above par.
Yeah.
Just want to really put a highlighter on that.
Yeah. I mean, it was.
Guys, if you're driving, you can pull over. Mac did just say that it was difficult for him to shoot over par. Okay, back to where we were. Go ahead.
Well, and it was like golf was easy and it was fun, you know, and that was the thing. It was easy and it was fun and it was a game.
Right.
And I loved playing it. And when I went there, it became work. And within the first, they're like, you got to rebuild your swing. You won't be able to play college golf.
Yeah, they took you out of the low draw and put you in
like, you got to hit a high fade.
Ugh, gross.
And I couldn't, I literally was like getting up and down from everywhere to be able to break 80, you know?
Whoa.
And I remember my dad came out and watched me play a tournament like 60 days after I'd been there. and down at Champions Gate in Orlando, and he showed up and he was like, what is, I'm like pop skying drivers, like I'm standing over the ball for like a minute. He's like, what has happened to you?
Oh no.
And so it took me a while to sort of like get the game back. But it's, yeah, it's, I think ever since then, for the last like 20 years, I really haven't enjoyed golf. I'm like finding my way to enjoy it. So you talk about like how it's work for me. It's actually like, I really have a deep love for the game. I'm trying to find it almost like UGP is like a way for me to try to find my love for the game again.
Well, in a lot of ways, you know, you're maybe undoing some of the things that happened to you, right, as a kid, like with new people, right? And you're allowing them to go through the way that maybe it could have gone for you. I don't know. I'm putting words in your mouth, but the idea is maybe UGP is an opportunity, kind of like Blake has had, to maybe not put shoes on golfers, but to maybe supply them with the best game that they can go out there with.
Yeah, and I think me and Blake have talked about that a lot, and you know, in aligning our stories, it's just, you know, there's so much from, you know, swing thoughts is getting rid of swing thoughts and making golf fun. And I think for me, that's why, you know, I'm kind of an ideal person to run an academy like this and an institution like this, because I'd had that burnout and that bad experience. And I've had, you know,
I've had multiple
ACL reconstructions as well. So I've had my ACL redone on my left, you know, that was also right in high school. Right before I went to play college golf. And so that the knee surgeries, the physical therapy that ensued, the swing thoughts, like, you know, equipment, all this stuff where, you know, I have a lot of empathy for the player that wants to improve and gets bounced around and actually gets worse.
So, you know, sitting here with two pretty legit entrepreneurs, right, working both separately and together to do awesome things. One of the questions I get a lot is like kind of, you know, people admiring my job, which is sort of a weird job that I fell into.
It's a pretty awesome job.
Kind of similar to your job.
I've admired it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Oh, that's really meaningful to hear. Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, it's funny because I look at when you explain that the two biggest aha moments of your life, Blake, come from looking at a pile of laundry and looking at a bare foot.
Yeah.
Like, that's pretty powerful. You know what I mean? Like, I almost really think about it like in the movie of your life, right? Mm-hmm. Whenever whoever Michael Keaton's kid is at the time that's going to play you. I just see them literally, and like I see it in slow-mo. The camera kind of wraps around and he's there in Argentina.
Argentina, yeah.
And he just sees the foot. Maybe it's got an ugly toe or whatever. And you're just like, I want to put a shoe on that foot. You know, like, I don't know. But like for me, I look at those moments and, well, maybe they seem so obvious now. Right. But looking back on it, what is that ability in that you have that, quote, makes you a good entrepreneur, not necessarily in carrying it out, but in recognizing the opportunity there? Because anyway, the background is, I get a lot of questions from people. How do I get your job?
Yeah, sure.
And I'm like, I don't fucking know.
Yeah.
It would kind of be like saying someone, how do I get your job? It's like, well, I don't know. I just saw a problem.
Yeah. So it'd be interesting to see if you would say the same thing. If you thought about how you created your job and how I created mine, I always say that, like, it's recognizing like a small thing that you love or want to do and just kind of doing it and not worrying about, is this a business? Is this a company? Is this going to work? Like, I mean, when I met those kids in Argentina, like, my initial goal was to put 200 shoes on kids' feet. And like, and I wasn't sure. And I didn't even open up a bank account because I didn't think it was a business. I thought it was, you know, this is something fun I'm going to do as a project. We call it the Tom's Project originally, not even Tom's Business.
I like that.
And so
that could be the elite sort of line. Yeah. Now. Wait, so
you didn't run home
and be like, no. I got $1 million idea.
No. I had another.
That's
company.
I hear that a lot nowadays.
Yeah.
I got $1 million idea.
See, I think that's the differences, and probably, you know, when you had your first idea to, you know, make a video about, you know, traveling around the world, playing golf in interesting places or meeting interesting people, it was probably your curiosity and like, hey, this will be fun. Like, maybe I'll make some money. But what I really am going to do is I'm going to have a fucking awesome time.
Yeah.
You know, at least that's what I get by watching you.
That's accurate.
So just the same thing. I was like, okay, if I can sell 200 pairs of shoes, come back at Christmas, how fun is it going to be to give all these kids a pair of shoes? And plus, I loved Argentina. I mean, I was single, I was beautiful women there,
right.
I was having a lot of fun, like, you know, I was learning to play polo, all these things. So it was like, this was like an idea that was going to, A, be very gratifying in helping these kids get shoes. It was going to be a lot of fun. And it just turned out to be an incredible business.
Right.
So I think that what I tell people all the time is like, if you set out to create a business idea, to make a lot of money, almost 90% of the time that fails. No one chooses to be an entrepreneur. They become an entrepreneur. And they become an entrepreneur because they see a problem in the world that they want to fix. Max sees all these amateurs burdened by swing thoughts, not able to get all the best instruction, training, et cetera, in one place. So he has a passion to help, you know, amateur golfers. It turns into a business, UGP. You know, you had a passion to travel, tell golfer stories. It turns into business that you have today. Same with Tom's. And so I say, like if you look at the great companies in the world, all the big brands, I mean, whether it's Starbucks or it's Apple or it's whatever, like, you know, Steve Jobs wasn't like trying to come up with a business idea. He was like fascinated with how computers could change people's lives. You know, Howard Schultz was in Italy and he's like, why don't we have this beautiful espresso experience? We're drinking fucking Folgers. I mean, yeah. You know, so I'm sorry with all the cussing.
I had a fucking Starbucks this morning okay. And I fucking loved it.
I don't know my audience. So anyways, but that's, I think that's like literally I speak so many places. It's such a joy for me to share my experience with others because so many people have helped me. But that's the one piece of advice I'm so consistent on is like, if you look at entrepreneurs and say, that's the lifestyle I want, that's what I want to do. I say, stop thinking about being an entrepreneur and start thinking about what do you want to change in the world? What's not working? And it could be my coffee machine's not working, or, you know, I want to have a better fitting pair of jeans. I mean, it doesn't have to be a lofty goal. Like I want to help children from suffering, but that's how you become an entrepreneur. That's how you actually create the dream job.
I feel like you must have like a little like hat with just like 500 ideas in it.
So I do many. Get a lot. That's the hard thing is that once you've seen a few of your ideas turn into businesses that work, then you can sometimes develop, you know, the overconfidence that any idea you have is a good idea. And that's not good.
What's the worst idea Blake's come up with? Like, I'm dying to know.
I mean, really, we should bring my wife in here because she might have a PhD in that, in the answer to that.
She'll give you a journal. The straight talk.
Yeah. Straight. I mean, I love what he said, and it's just, that's really inspiring for me. It's just really in doing a business, if you can start out with what value can I bring to the world, or what value can I, how can I improve other people's life through a business, and you're passionate about that, it's going to be really hard to fail, especially if you're, you know, if you're passionate about it and you care about it and you really want to, you know, provide a service that might not exist, or a fragmented, you know, industry like golf, and say, hey, I want to provide a value. I want to improve the way that this is done. And obviously you got to have some talent behind it, but if you, and some experience, but if you care and you're trying to make people's lives better, then it's just a constantly getting that feedback and refining the concept as you go along.
Right.
I mean, I have another example, and it actually is golf related. So my brother worked for me at Tom's. Like, he was one of the very first employees, and he saw the whole thing. I mean, the good, the bad, the ugly. I mean, he was sleeping on the couch doing customer service. And, you know, after doing that for many years, he decided he wanted to go off and do his own thing. He loves golf. And one of the things he is like spends all his money on is every year buying a new driver, right? They come out, he like can't, literally he cannot keep himself from buying a new driver, even though it's $600, right?
Right.
And so he came up with this idea. He launched it like 4 months ago. It's called Dollar Driver Club.
Oh, snap.
Have you heard of it? You've heard of it. Yeah.
I'm so, into it.
Yeah. Have you heard of it?
I know.
Dollar a day. And you literally can have any driver, whatever shaft, everything you want. And then if you don't like it, you just send it back and he sends you a new one.
What?
So you never have to buy a driver again. What? But that came from his passion. He wasn't thinking like, oh, I want to come up with a great business idea. Like, I don't even know if it's going to make money.
Right.
And I don't think he really knows yet. But it was like, I just want everyone to have the best driver and not be so stressed about putting $600 on their credit card.
I mean, I don't know about you, Mac, but I don't pay for clubs, and I would join the Dollar Driver Club.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I just think that's a great idea. Like,
I mean, for Tyler, driver. He just wanted to have the newest driver every month, so.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But that's, I mean, you build the service because you know, there's a void that you feel is there, and
yeah. What's the movie where they say, see a need, fill a need? What is that? It's like a cartoon movie, isn't it?
Oh,
It's like,
well, I don't know about that, but I think a Field of Dreams, build it and they will come.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Right.
I need to rewatch that.
That's a great movie.
Okay, Blake, what do you get out of golf that you don't get out of any other thing? I mean, because surfing must give you a lot. Polo, I don't know what the hell's going on. I'm afraid of horses. I'm allergic to them. I can't talk about it. I'm terrified of horses. If you're not afraid of horses, are you afraid of horses?
I appreciate horses.
All right, there you go. I'll take that's acceptable.
Respect.
Survey says ding ding ding. What do you get out of golf that you don't?
One of the things that you get, and it's one of the things that I've talked about with my dad a ton. It's like we just get time with each other. We get time off our phones. We get off all the dings and stresses and distractions. And we get to, you know, spend 4 hours walking with a friend, connecting deeply, and at the same time, having something that you can be competitive with and enjoy. And so for me, it's such sacred time on the golf course. And I think that's why now I'm less interested in always winning or winning the bet or winning the tournament and more interested in like, man, I'm going to get 4 hours with my dad and my brother today. Or Mac and I mean, some of our best meetings and strategy sessions for UGP have been when we go out and play golf, because now we're not sitting at a table like with like cortisol levels up, like stressed about like, oh, how are we going to hit these numbers or how are we going to do this? Instead, we're like playing golf. And Mac's like, hey, I've got a really tough HR situation. You know, there's this person that's been with us for a while. It's just not working. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm thinking of this is how I'm going to handle it. And then I can be like, well, when I first started Tom's, like, this is what I did. I had a similar situation. And so we're able to, like, it's just an organic way to actually really be productive mm-hmm. and also build our friendship while, you know, trying to get this little ball in this little hole.
Right.
So for me, I think that's one of the things I love about golf. Like surfing, you can sit out there and talk between sets with a friend, but you're like constantly focusing on is the set coming? And then usually you're in different parts of the lineup or whatever, and there's tons of other people out there. Golf, you really get that time together. And so in the summertime when I play a lot of my favorite golf is my wife and I go 9 holes, 6-pack of beer. She likes to drink gin, so she'll have like her Moscow Mules with gin, not vodka. And she'll have a little pitcher of that, and I'll have my beers, and we'll go play 9 holes, and we stop talking about the kids and the schedules and all the stuff that we typically stress over. Instead, we just like enjoy the game and enjoy each other. And so that's what golf gives me the most right now, is time with the people I care the most about.
That's great. That's really important. Yeah. I like that.
It is, especially today. Like, there's so many distractions in our lives.
Just maybe a short answer, but does polo do that? Or what is it?
Polo is meditation.
Is
like,
it?
It's full on, like, whoa. I mean, it is so scary. It is so fast. It is so intense. And like literally, if your mind wanders for one moment, you're in big trouble. And so it to me, like I'll play a polo match and I'm physically just totally spent and it's totally exhilarating. But then I get done and I'm like, where did the last hour go? Like it's that deep of a meditation.
I'm just thinking adventures in polo. I'm just thinking,
here we go.
How can we crack in?
I would love to teach you to ride a horse and hit the ball.
Let's go spend a day with him in Jackson.
Dude, can we do that?
We come to Jackson and we should do polo, mountain climbing, and golf all in one day.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in.
Yeah,
sure. Actually, my parents had their 50th wedding anniversary at a Jenny Lake Lodge.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah.
So we went up beautiful. And I played Snake River.
Yeah,
And
that's
played,
a hard course.
It's hard.
Yeah,
it's hard.
Lots of opportunities to lose balls.
You know, what I really enjoyed was Jackson Hole golf and tennis.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah,
Jackson Hole golf and tennis. Low key, Robert Trent Jones.
Yeah, all the views of the Tetons. My house is literally right next to Jackson Hole golf and tennis.
Okay.
On a ranch on that river right there.
Oh,
and
sick.
So literally 5 minutes away, and then we play at Shooting Star. I love.
Oh
did
yeah.
You play Shooting Star?
I didn't. No, I didn't. But
yeah. Fazio course. Yeah. Incredible. But yeah, we could have a really fun day.
I love that.
We could climb the Grand. Have you ever done that?
No.
The Grand Teton.
The 16,000 foot like sheer rock face?
Yeah, yeah.
Haven't climbed that one yet.
We can do that. There's a couple easy. There's some easy routes up.
Have you heard of National Outdoor Leadership School?
Yes. Yeah.
I did that for 2 years.
Oh, that's cool.
In the summer.
Summer you did?
No. When I was like 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
We did Wind Rivers.
Yeah, Wind Rivers is great.
Yeah, up there. A lot of fly fishing.
Yeah, a lot of fly fishing.
And, you know, I'm excited.
Jackson's the best because you have everything. You have fly fishing, golf. Polo.
Yeah, polo. I would never have guessed. Dude, that sounds really great. I'm really excited. I'm going on a camping trip in a couple weeks, and it's been a while for me. It's been like maybe a year, but maybe real longer since I've gone on a real camping trip. So we're pretty excited.
Good.
But I was going to ask, have you played golf? You've traveled a lot. Have you played any weird rounds of golf out there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm dying.
Okay, one of my favorite rounds, and we actually have video of this too. Was we were on a giving trip in South Africa.
Okay, this is a giving trip is...
Tom's giving trip. We're putting shoes on kids' feet who don't have shoes. Like, super...
That must be emotional.
Incredibly, it can be. And over time, I think it's gotten more, like, joyful than sad because I've seen, you know, I've seen a lot of poverty and I've seen a lot of tough things, but I've also seen the joy that comes from something simple like a pair of shoes. But this is 2007. We've only given 50,000 shoes away at this point. I take, you know, my parents are there, my friends, like we're all in South Africa, and we're traveling around to these different, you know, kind of like townships, like, you know, kind of areas that are really impoverished, and it is emotional. And it's interesting you brought that up, because after a day of this, especially in the early days, you're just emotionally spent.
Yeah.
So you want to blow off some steam. Like, yeah. You're kind of frustrated, like there's too much HIV here, there's this, there's these problems, like, but you need a place to, and so what we found early on is to blow off steam, we'd go to a bar. And so we're driving, and we're thinking of going to this, you know, place in the middle of nowhere, and we drive by, and we see something golf pub. I mean, literally in the middle of nowhere.
Wait, what country are we in again?
In South Africa.
Okay.
Yeah. So we pull over, and we go, and there's literally this tiny little pub, and there's a 9-hole pitch and putt, you know, all par threes, like goat track. And they have like the oldest clubs you've ever seen. And like there's a couple of us that play golf, and we are like so excited. So we pound a few beers, go out there, we start betting. My buddy Alejo, who's my original partner from Argentina, and he thinks he's the best at everything.
Right.
And so we have this bet. And so luckily we were making a documentary on Tom's at the same time. So we had some camera guys. So I had this shot like 40 yards off the green, and I said, watch, this is how you knock it in the hole. True shot, hit it, bounce in the hole. And we have it on film.
Amazing.
At this course. And literally, it's like one of my, I saw the documentary screening. It's actually going to premiere, I think, next year.
Oh, exciting.
So it's not out yet. But I saw a cut of it the other day, and it's in the documentary. I'm like, yes! I don't care what else is in there. The greatest shot ever on the most, but that course is like one of those places, like, I don't know how you would ever find it, but it exists. And it was like, it was given to us by the golf gods, because we all needed that break from how intense of a emotional day we had.
Yeah. I could just see the scene where you're like sitting there like in a 90-minute screening with all these like technical aspects of Tom's, and you're like, I just have one note. I would love that shot of me chipping. Can you put that back in and put some real triumphant music under it? Yeah. Dude, that's so cool.
Yeah. So that's one of my best memories in terms of like just totally random. The second one is, and this one actually is also on film, is my sister and I were on the TV show The Amazing Race.
Yes, I remember. Yeah.
And so season two, and in The Amazing Race, we were in Namibia. I think that's right. Yeah, Namibia.
Is there Namibia and Namibia?
Or maybe it's Namibia.
I don't know.
You're probably getting it right. But we're in that country
a lot of countries
that is in Africa,
Africa
that's very hot. Actually, you know what? I'm sorry. We weren't in Namibia. We were in Australia.
I mean,
Cooper Pedy.
To be fair, Amazing Australia. Race is like... Wait, you were in Cooper Pedy?
Yeah, yeah.
What?
So this is it. Yeah, yeah. So Cooper Pedy is the hottest place on the planet.
I've been there.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
Have you played the golf course?
Dude, we just released the episode of Cooper Pedy, like, you know, in October.
On the Black Sand golf course. Yeah. So we were on that Amazing Race. And so one of the challenges on the Amazing Race was you had to play 3 holes... And in Cooper
no.
Pedy. Yeah. And it's like 140 degrees. Your skin is getting burnt off you.
You were in the summer there. You were in our winter? January.
So it's
their summer.
It's the hottest, hottest time possible.
Flies everywhere.
Yeah. It's so nasty. So this is also on, you can get this from CBS. So my sister, who learned to play golf from my dad too, that's where it all came from. My dad just loves golf. She doesn't play much, but my dad taught her to play as a small girl. So it's her turn for the challenge. And I'm thinking, please, I need to be hitting this golf shot, not you.
Yeah.
And she hits this like 130-yard shot, like perfectly, and it bounces up and goes right next to the hole. I hit it in the putt, and then we go on to win that challenge.
Amazing.
So those are the two most odd and triumphant golf experiences I've had. And they're both documented on film.
Yeah, I don't know.
I
many want to people.
See your Cooper Pedy episode.
I'll show it to you, dude.
Yeah,
I'm excited for you to see it. It's actually one of my favorite episodes I've ever done.
Really?
And it was one of those I don't know, man. I mean, it's weird because we went in and we were on a time crunch.
Yeah.
I was very uncomfortable of the heat.
Yeah.
We were even there in the winter time. It was May for us, so it was like.
So not as hot as it when I was there.
No, not even nearly. I mean, like, I was like, what do you do with the flies when they're bad? And he was like, they wear fly nets on their face.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, God. This
so sounds intense. Pleasant.
When you meet people from Australia and you tell them you've been to Cooper Pedy, it's like you get so much credibility. They're like, really? You've been there? Like, tell me about it. And then you tell them about the opal mining.
Yeah.
You tell them about the golf course. And they're like, shit, you've been there.
So here's a detail about Cooper Pedy. Do you know that they have reciprocal rights with the old course?
No.
Swear to God.
Come on.
So the RNA, it's the weirdest thing ever. The RNA came down to, they were in Australia. like back in the day, I don't know the purpose of the visit. It was probably like something to do with Royal Melbourne or, you know, I don't know, New South Wales or something. And anyway, they're in Coober Pedy because it's a tourist attraction.
Yeah.
And the opal used to be a huge business, like mining opal, which is this like iridescent stone or gem.
Yeah.
I don't even know what it is. But anyway, now it's just a tourist attraction and you're like, what is this? You know, it's not worth anything. But the RNA, they were there and they were like, we would like a mine. And they were like, well, we can help you with that. We would love reciprocal rights to the old course.
Really?
I mean, yeah. The Augusta member's gone?
That would be really good. Have you played Augusta?
Once with my dad. It was amazing. Yeah.
Have you played it, Mac?
I haven't.
Come on.
No, come on.
Get of our level. That's hilarious. Yeah, I have not met anyone really who's like played Coober Pedy on a reality show that's really good. First of all, The Amazing Race is a legit show.
Yeah.
Like you need like a towel around your neck to watch it.
Yeah, it's good.
Or played, you know, when you're talking about the 9-hole South African course, what it really touched for me on is this idea that the best adventures really are hard to plan.
Yes, they're really hard to plan. And that's one of the things I love about, you know, Tom's, like, on these giving trips. Like, we go with the purpose of helping people, but we always get into crazy adventures, whether it's in Nepal or Peru or Guatemala.
You play golf in Nepal?
I didn't play golf in Nepal, but I did some, like, crazy meditation stuff, like, in the Himalayas that I never would have planned.
Right.
But we were there helping
people
with eyesight. Yeah, Rishikesh.
There you go.
Yeah.
This guy.
Jesus. I went to Rishikesh on my honeymoon, actually. Yeah, that's a whole nother story.
Jesus, yeah. You are one of the few people that needs
and
a
I played elephant polo on my honeymoon.
Did you really?
Yeah.
So let's talk polo. We're gonna circle back for polo.
We'll do that in the summer.
We got a few more minutes. Mac, what have you had any crazy golf adventures in your life? You grew up in West Texas playing in the wind,
yeah,
hooking around a low draw. You've come over to a fade. Now what?
I don't know what it does now.
Have you had any wild traveling golf adventures?
Well, you know, growing up on the border there, obviously in El Paso,
right.
Juarez is right there, and my whole
Juarez for those of us that
I know. I tried to make it as
you tried. So Juarez is this town. If you're in El Paso,
Ciudad Juarez.
It's Ciudad Juarez. If you're in El Paso, you're in America, and there's the Rio Grande,
mm-hmm,
right there, the big river. If you're speaking Spanish, right over it, you see Juarez, which is literally. Literally, it looks like a flaming mess.
I mean, I grew up on the 15th hole of El Paso Country Club, and my mom's house is probably 15 minutes from the Mexico border, 8 minutes to the New Mexico border, but it's in Texas.
Right.
So there's some houses in our neighborhood that are in New Mexico and in Texas as well. So you really have that blend of New Mexican culture with Mexican culture with Texan culture all in El Paso. It's a really interesting place.
Wow. New meaning to Tex-Mex, I guess.
The
what
whole
is Tex-Mex, by the way? What is it?
It's a bunch of cheese.
Cheese.
You know, spice
like
and cheese.
Mexican food with cheese.
Have yeah, you have exactly. you played in Juarez or in Mexico? Oh,
so I was going to say, my dad was the head panel physician for the U.S. consulate to Mexico, so he's a public health doctor, so immigration, you know, visa processing, all the things that you would need to do to get medically screened to be able to come to the United States as a legal immigrant.
You have to get a physical before you become a citizen?
Oh, yeah, you have to. I mean,
I think it's fucking Americans should need a physical to stay American.
Everything. I mean, TB is one of the biggest. Tuberculosis is one of the biggest things. So it's a big thing in developing. Designed and constructed the largest open-air tuberculosis clinic.
I just saw Blake make $180 million. I just watched Blake look up and to the left of the teepee, and he actually just was on The Price is Right.
So my dad, his father was the first panel physician for the U.S. consulate to Mexico. So I grew up with, like, you know, the clinic is in Juarez, and we would... I mean, I'd go there probably once a week. Christmases were always in Juarez. My grandmother lived there.
In Juarez, but she wasn't a citizen.
She was a Mexican citizen. My grandmother's from Guadalajara, and my grandfather's from Manzanillo, Mexico. And
right.
So and then they came to Juarez and started this clinic, and he was like a really interesting doc. His story is crazy. I mean, he was an orphan that became like a pretty famous physician in Mexico, and all five of his kids became professionals.
Kind of its own Cinderella story.
It's amazing. Like, he was an amazing, I think he spoke like 10, 11 languages. He was just incredible. I mean, he was like kind of raised by the Communist Party too in Mexico. The intellectuals back in the day in Mexico were socialist communists. So
is that cool? I'm thinking cool.
It's interesting. He was cool. I mean, he was a really interesting guy. He's half Scottish.
No shit.
Yeah, his father's name was Caleb Aurelius Todd. And so weird Mexicans with the name last name Todd. So my grandfather was like an incredible man. And so
I would love to see a photo.
He's my screen. That's his statue. Oh,
well, fucking hey, that's like, I've never had that come up so fast.
Yeah.
Wait, this is a bronze bust
at the clinic.
Yeah, it's not just a photo. Have you seen this?
Oh yeah.
At his clinic.
Can we get a? I don't know where this is best. Maybe right there. Yeah. That's Caleb Aurelius Todd.
Well, that was his father. So his name was Oscar.
Oscar Todd. Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. And so he was an amazing man and a big inspiration as an entrepreneur.
Watch the mic there. Just try to.
As an entrepreneur, as a physician, I mean, he was an awesome guy. So my father was the only doctor out of the five kids, and then he took over the clinic and was in that. So I was a we were members at Juarez Country Club, Campestre Juarez is called.
No way.
And so yeah, really amazing caddy program, like really interesting experience. And so growing up,
I would love to go there.
Oh, it's really cool.
Is this the same? Forgive me. Is this the same location that was used in Sicario?
Yes,
it is, right?
Yes, like I mean that border. I would cross that bridge literally sometimes twice, 2 to 3 times a week.
Did you watch Sicario and were you like, oh my god?
Oh yeah, I mean I remember sitting on that bridge so many times. It was all filmed right there. The shooting scene at the top of the bridge.
Such a good.
That's kind of where my parents met at the top of that bridge.
We didn't see that. I haven't seen it.
Oh, it's so good, awesome. Dude. Yeah. If you
I see it pop up on my Netflix thing all the time.
Dude, yeah. It's a real film.
Yeah,
okay. And just make sure you watch it like when you got to have the sound.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it won actually an audio award because the music the audio effects are insane.
It's intense. Yeah, but that's it's 2010 when the violence got really heavy. On that note, my family was paying like something like $2 million a year for security detail. We'd have armored cars to go to lunch and to dinner and to go to the clinic. Caravans, they'd have in front and behind us, flanking us, bulletproof doors. So it got heavy. It got heavy. There was a curfew at like 8 o'clock. My dad got hijacked his car, and they even made they were all former Israeli military, the security that we had. And they took all of his stuff and left him on the side of the road. I mean, it was really dangerous for a while. So growing up, though, I mean, we would go over all the time, play golf. We'd go to dinner, things are starting to restore at least a little bit. But yeah, definitely in 2010, it was the height. My grandfather died in 2010, and actually that was my wife's first time going to El Paso, and we were just starting to date. And so I took her there to meet my family. It was at my grandfather's funeral, and she was like, "This is." We went. Code word right when you cross the bridge. We had
what was the code word?
I don't remember, but we had like 40 security guards, 40 guys with like 40 guys with like big guns, like standing outside because they were hitting funeral processions. They were hitting, right. There was kind of no limits.
It's kind of crazy. It's like one of the things, it's like these experiences, right, that you've had in other countries, these adventures, you do kind of come back to America. Right, and you're filled with a feeling. I don't know. Do you ever get? Do you know what I'm talking about? Like, I mean, we all live in LA. We have wonderful lives. We're filled with like opportunity and luck, and I don't. I sometimes struggle with that feeling of fortune, right? Yeah. Whether it's not financial necessarily in my case, but yeah. I mean, how do you? I mean, you obviously Blake's in the clear because he's given a bunch of shit away. But me, I got to deal with that. I don't know. But you know what I mean? Like,
no, yeah.
How do you manage that feeling of like, why am I so fortunate?
I think the thing is I try to, frame it of, too much that has been given, there is great responsibility. And so not to make it real heavy, but I try to say, okay, I've been given a lot of blessings well before, we had, the kind of financial success we've had. And so how can I, use that, those blessings to also be responsible and help others? And you can do that in small ways. You can do that just being kind. You can do that by letting someone in on the freeway. I mean, there's so many simple ways. It doesn't have to be some huge thing you do, but I think that's the way that I've always looked at, like, how can we be in a state of enjoying our lives, because I think we really are truly set on this planet to enjoy what we've been given, but at the same time understand that not everyone has been given the same opportunities, and how can I help someone? And it starts little and sometimes it grows into bigger things like Tom's, but anytime you're helping someone or having that mentality, I think it allows you to kind of the balance to work with all the stuff that you get to experience. But it's hard. I mean, there's always an adjustment period when I come back from a giving trip, And I can't wait until my kids are old enough that I can take them, because I think that's going to be one of the greatest things I can give them, is like perspective of like, we live in this fairy tale life here in Topanga, but it's not how everyone's living, and And so there's a lot that you're going to ultimately be responsible for.
Yeah, and well, some of my favorite quotes have been around the idea that, you know, just the incredible educational experience, right, of travel and just how you can't replicate it and you'd be better off, you know, traveling for a day than studying for years or something.
Yeah, no, you learn so much. And I think that unplanned nature, it's like having like a general idea of what you're doing, but then letting so much of it just unfold and being open to that spontaneity. Those have been my best travel experiences for sure.
Yeah. Well, we got to wind it down here. Any topics really quick before we end, or should we just say goodbye? I mean, I always do that, and then, you know, usually we end up going for another, like, hour.
So. I know, I wish we could. Yeah. Well, we definitely have to continue this. I feel like this should be part one.
I love it.
There's a lot to be experienced.
Yeah.
You know, the teepee's nice, but it would be nice doing this on a portaledge on the side of the Grand Teton.
I love that idea, and I'll be totally honest. I mean, Colt, here, you and I have spent a lot of time together. Have we ever met someone who has lived adventures in golf?
I was going to say, you guys are very similar.
Right. I've never seen anything like that.
When you can say when you can name a town in Nepal that you've been to and be like, oh yeah, that place. That's when you know you're on the same level.
Do either of you guys have any questions for these guys? We have 4 minutes left. Hit them quick. Yes,
one
no.
One always is, what are you obsessed with right now?
Ooh, I like that one. What are you obsessed
with? Well, I'm obsessed with my blood glucose levels.
Oh yeah.
I about 2 days ago injected my stomach.
So, you know, we got it on the, I'll reflect people to the video because we got that, right?
Yeah. That's what I'm obsessed with right now is understanding what foods are affecting my blood glucose.
If you're interested in the next level, is this even legal, Blake?
Yeah,
is
totally legal.
Is it? He's got like, did you ever see what is it? Not Terminator. Red Planet, where Arnold Schwarzenegger has the jewel inside of his nose.
Yeah.
He has that on his stomach. Anyway, we have it on the vlog. you can see images of it. Mac, what are you obsessed with?
My kids right now.
Solid.
I think so much. I mean, it's Halloween, right? So just for their costumes tonight. And my little boy's name is Sevi, actually. So daughter, yeah. Sophia. And so, yeah, they're...
Is Sophia after a golfer or is that a family member?
Sophia?
Yeah.
My wife chose the name. She's like, I get the girl, you get the boy.
It's a beautiful name.
Yeah. Sophia Michelle. And then Sevi Luis after my dad. After Sevi Ballesteros and my dad.
I like it. I could have guessed Sevi Ballesteros. Andrew, you're up. Quick one. Let's go.
What are all of your kids dressing up for Halloween?
Ooh, that's good. So
good timely question.
It's so funny. Yeah, Mac asked me that question when we got to the house today. My son Summit, he's almost 4. He literally has changed his mind 5 times in the last 3 weeks. It went from, I want to be a skeleton, so I ordered skeleton costumes on Amazon. And then it was, I want to be a leopard. And so we got in the leopard costume, which he's actually been wearing the last week to all these kind of pre-Halloween parties that my parents and my wife has taken him to. And then yesterday, a day before Halloween, with absolute conviction, he goes, Dad, you and I are both going to be Superman.
Ooh.
And I said, Summit, we don't have Superman costumes. And he says, go to your phone and get one. And so I was like, okay. So I go on Amazon, get next day delivery. I'm praying that it gets here in time for the trick-or-treating.
Whoa, and we're in the sticks.
Yeah, we're in the sticks. But if it doesn't, we have skeleton costumes to fall back on. But I'm hoping that we'll both be Superman. And my daughter already... She's only 1, so she didn't have a lot of voice in this, but she already my wife had gotten her a Wonder Woman costume. So the Superman thing actually could come full circle and be great, but my wife's feeling a little left out because she already was on board to do the leopard thing with Summit. So she's stuck with this leopard outfit. So it might be 1 leopard and 2 Superman and 1 Wonder Woman. Yeah. So.
The Avengers and the leopard.
I mean, all I have to say is tune in next week when we see what happens.
Exactly.
Mac, just golfers, or what are you going to do?
Sevi was going to be a ghost, and just like that was going to be a cheap outfit, just a little sheet and poke some holes in it.
But I like that.
He changed it up, and he's, I don't know, he's going to be some sort of like king, prince with a sword, with a shield, and my wife, you know, makeshifted something. And then my daughter's been planning for months. She's been planning her routes. We drive by house, she's like, that's a good house, that's not a good house, that's a good house.
Wow.
Yeah, she's ready to go, and so she knows, like, she's like, I'm probably going to get 135 pieces of candy. And I'm going to eat 30 of them, and I'll save the other ones for later. You can have all my
Reese's. Become a financial planner. Morgan Stanley, if you're listening
to
this.
Forecasting.
This is the prize you right here.
So she's going to be a witch, and she's already, like, had audition. She's already, like, you know, shit's ready to go. Black lipstick, hat, the whole thing.
I love it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time, guys. I really appreciate it.
So fun.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Have a great week, everybody. Thanks for listening.